the spiritual path for tens of thousands of people in Japan, Southeast Asia, and the USA, where Alan Watts, one of the West's foremost writers and exponents of this teaching, lives. Pat Williams visited his home in California to record this tape on Zen, the Eternal Now. Can Zen be called a religion, is her first question.
The word religion goes back basically to the idea of a rule of life and obedience to something revealed as the will of God. And therefore, it involves beliefs and obedience to certain moral commandments delivered to you by a higher authority. This is not in Buddhism at all. Although there are precepts in Buddhism, although there are disciplines in Buddhism, they are not done by way of obedience. They are things which you do on your own authority. And so the word religion isn't quite right. In a way, Zen is more like, but not at all absolutely like, psychotherapy. It's a method of changing one's state of consciousness. Even though I have to make reservations about the word method, as we shall subsequently see, nevertheless, the basic principle of Zen is a transformation of one's consciousness from the feeling that one is a lonely and separated individual, somehow caught in the midst of an alien universe, to the realization that whatever you are and whatever the universe is are the same.
Now, are there, as in psychotherapy, graduated techniques for doing this, or how does it come about?
Well, there are and there aren't. That is to say, Zen is called the Sudden School. That is to say, the school of sudden attainment of Buddhahood, of awakening, of realization that the problem of the differentiation between you and the universe is completely unreal. That the dreads of death and that attachment to life is completely unnecessary.
Now, can we set that in its context? Because it sounds like something which begins to disturb people later on in their lives. Is Zen something that a young man will be interested in? Or go to a school to study?
It is the practice that in the Orient, the Zen schools are full of young people. But alas, they are sent there by their pious parents. And they don't necessarily have any natural vocation to be interested in Zen practice. On the other hand, in the United States, and I think in England, there are an enormous number of young people who are very genuinely interested in this, because they see an alteration in our state of consciousness as the only basic solution to our ecological problems, and to many other problems besides, in human relations, family relations, and so on. They feel that we have somehow to overcome the egocentric predicament.
Now, there is at the moment, all over the West, the feeling that this problem must be overcome, and Zen presumably is a way of approaching this.
Yes, and it's a way that it has excited people very much, because of the idea of getting it suddenly. You know, Zen is full of stories. Almost all Zen literature are these so-called mondo, or question and answer situations. And the primordial one is Bodhidharma's first disciple, whose name was Hweka. And he came to Bodhidharma and said, "I have no peace of mind. Please will you pacify my mind?" And Bodhidharma said to him, "Lay your mind out here in front of me and I will pacify it." But he said, "Sir, when I look for it, I can't find it." And Bodhidharma replied, "There, I've pacified it." And instantly. Now, Zen is full of tales like that. And they're often very funny. And people, as soon as Nukaya and Suzuki translated them, people became fascinated with this way of things. And another thing was that we had not in the West been accustomed, except among the Hasidim Jews, to an element of humor in religion, to an element of almost slapstick humor.
Can you tell me some stories to illustrate these?
Yes. Once upon a time there was a Confucian scholar who was asking a master about the secret teaching of Zen. And he replied, there's nothing secret, it's just as your own teacher Confucius said, when he said, do you think I'm holding anything back from you, my disciples? Indeed, I'm holding nothing back. And so the Confucian scholar said, I don't understand. And a day later, they were walking together on a mountain path, and they stopped beside a bush of wild laurel. And the teacher said, do you smell it? The Confucian scholar said, yes. You see, said the teacher, I'm holding nothing back.
That's lovely.
Now, I could explain this, but the explanation would be unavailing, in the sense that if I explain the meaning of a joke which you haven't seen, you get a throat laugh instead of a belly laugh. The teacher is, of course, pointing always to the non-verbal world.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you explain the Confucian? He is somebody, is he, who has no contact yet with the non-verbal world?
No, because Confucian scholars are entirely absorbed in words. As your great scholar, Joseph Needham of Cambridge, has pointed out, the Confucians never developed science because they were scholastics interested only in books and ceremonies and sort of ritual behavior. Whereas the Taoists, and you must remember that Zen is a kind of merger between Indian Buddhism and Chinese Taoism, the Taoists were interested in nature. They were interested in the flow of water, the behavior of air, the generation of plants, and all kinds of natural phenomena. So was Zen. Zen was not primarily interested in books, although Suzuki was a great scholar, and before him the Chinese Shumitsu was a great scholar. Zen can take scholarship in its stride, but it is not primarily interested in books. It has been traditionally defined in four phrases: a direct transmission of awakened consciousness outside tradition and outside scripture, no dependence on words and letters, direct pointing to the human heart, seeing into one's own nature and realizing Buddhahood. So then, we get to the essence of Zen by a temporary suspension of thought. We stop commenting, we stop talking to ourselves, stop figuring to ourselves about who we are and what the world is, and you can enter into it most simply, I think, by simply closing your eyes and listening to all the natural sounds that are going on, without trying to identify them or name them. And then, just listening to them as you would listen to classical music, to the music of Bach or Mozart, without asking, what does it mean? The music itself is its meaning. And so you listen to all the susurrus of what is going on in the world as you would listen to Bach. No comment. And subsequently also, you become aware of your breathing. You don't interfere with it. You become aware of it as is naturally going on, and so in two ways at the same time, you're playing with the air, with the play of the air on your eardrums, the play of the air in your lungs. Now then, it naturally arises when you look at breathing. Are you doing it, or is it happening to you? Or both? When you have no thoughts in your head, there is no one doing it. There is no subject of the verb, because that is a thought. Mm-hmm. There is no object of the verb, for that too is a thought. There is just now. Some people say, well, they listen to that, that it's physical. Other people say, no, everything's in your mind, it's all mental, it's all spiritual. But those are both philosophical concepts, equally. In Zen, there is no physical, there is no spiritual, there is just... And so, in this state of consciousness, which is what is cultivated in the practice called Zazen, or sitting meditation, every Buddha, you see, almost, is always sitting. And he is in the state of Zazen. He is sitting. And he is completely aware, or she, I might add, of what is, without putting a name on it. And so, in that state of consciousness, you have become again as a child, as you were originally when you were a baby, and nobody had brainwashed you.
Now, they discovered that, didn't they, when they ran an EEG machine on Zen monks.
Yes.
I remember recently. And they were capable, in a state of meditation, of reacting.
That is true, although I'm a little leery of this EEG feedback, because it is an attempt to measure the meditative consciousness scientifically. And that introduces an element of competition as to who has it and who doesn't, who qualifies and who doesn't. And although this came later into Zen, it defeats the purpose of Zen. Mm-hmm. Because in the state of Zazen, you must not be trying to attain a result. Because that's looking to the future. Mm. In the state of Zazen, you're in the eternal present.
Now, you've spoken about disciples. Do they have a specific period of discipleship? Is it long? Is it short? Do they get enlightened
well,
quickly?
One aficionado of Zen told me, he was a Japanese artist, you can understand it in 3 minutes, or it may take you 30 years.
Now, the three-minuter, when they exist, has a transaction with his master and then goes on his way by himself after that. Is that what would happen, or would he stay in a Zen monastery?
Not necessarily. To understand Zen, you don't have to stay in a monastery, and according to my view, you don't even have to have a master. After all, the sixth patriarch of Zen, who was one of its greatest geniuses, attained his understanding without any master, although a master later confirmed it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a great friend who's a Zen master, and he said to me a little while ago, I think you become my disciple. I said, who was Buddha's teacher? And he laughed and pointed his finger at me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I laughed at him, and he picked up a flowering clover and handed it to me. Huh. You see, I've never had a guru.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a maverick in that respect, but it can't be helped. So, Hui Huinan says definitely in his so-called Platform Sutra, that was written somewhere before 713 AD, that to practice Buddhism, it is not necessary to become a monk. It can be done at home.
When are the origins of Zen, as far as we actually know them?
I think the West first heard of Zen in about the year 1913, when a Japanese by the name of Kaiten Nukaya wrote a book called The Religion of the Samurai. Then it became, of course, much more widely known in 1927 when Dr. Daisetsu Suzuki wrote the first volume of his essays in Zen Buddhism. Zen itself really begins in China, approximately between the years 450 and 500 AD, when a Hindu, or rather, as you would say in England, an Indian, by the name of Bodhidharma, came from South India to China and began to teach the way of Zen. Zen is, of course, the Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese Chan, which in turn is the Chinese pronunciation of the Indian Sanskrit word jhana, which we find very difficult to translate. Very often it's been translated meditation, but I find the word contemplation probably better, because in the Western tradition, meditation usually means to think carefully over something, and the method of Zen is not thinking at all. The method of Zen is being very intensely aware of what is, without commenting on it. That is to say, without talking to oneself about it or figuring to oneself about it. You could say it is complete mental silence.
Now, in the East, in China and in Japan, Zen is still flourishing today, is it, or is it of less interest?
Well, I don't know what's going on in China. But there is Zen in Southeast Asia, in Malaya and Vietnam, but it flourishes mainly, so far as we know, in Japan and the United States of America, where we have the second largest Zen monastery in the world.
Do you have any idea why it should flourish so well here in the United States?
Well, and it's spreading to Europe very rapidly. The reason is simply that the standard brands of Jewish and Christian religion are too didactic. They talk all the time. Talk, telling God what he should do as if he didn't know, telling the people what they should do as if they would or could, and it's been perpetual chatter. Even Quakers in their silent meetings still think. And so our standard brand religions do not offer mystical experience. They don't offer the transformation of consciousness whereby we can transcend the egocentric illusion that we are strangers in the universe and opposed to it, and therefore need to conquer it and fight it and beat it into submission. This is our problem, you see. We have technology in itself is a wonderful thing. But technology in the hands of maniacs is a very bad thing. Now, most of us are maniacs because we are under the illusion that we are not apertures through which this universe is looking at itself. We think we are outside beings looking at the universe from a kind of separate, disconnected, and alienated point of view. And to my mind, that is a complete hallucination, as if one imagined one was a poached egg and was going around looking for a piece of toast to sit on.
Well, I was going to ask you to hallucinate further now. I mean, this is a terrible thing to ask someone like you to do, but perhaps you could play an imagination game this way, and that is simply to let people who are listening to this tape understand the possible course of the journey for someone who is studying Zen. Could we perhaps take an imaginary student,
yes,
and you could describe from the time he first goes to visit his master or gets interested in the subject, what might happen to him, the steps he might have to take, the various ideas he might have to approach only to leave them again, and so on. Is that possible?
Well, it is in a way. There are various courses he can take. He could, for example, inquire of the Buddhist Society of London where there are Zen teachers and go and submit himself to their discipline. Although there's one thing I would point out. We have a saying that anyone who goes to a psychiatrist ought to have his head examined. And that's a double entendre. Because, yes, if you insist that you've got to have a teacher, you've got to have one. And you've got to jump that hurdle. But always remember that when you accord authority to a teacher, or to a church, or to a Bible, it is your opinion. And therefore, in that sense, you yourself are the source of that authority. You did it. You submitted yourself to this. And therefore a Zen teacher will be very strict in forcing you to recognize that. He will at first refuse you and say, I'm too busy, I have too many students, and I can't take on another. And then you come back and become more insistent and more insistent until you have put yourself in the position of acknowledging that fellow as your authority. Now then, he's got you trapped. Huh? You can't withdraw with any grace. And so, what he's going to do is to show you step by step, that you're looking for what you already have. And as long as he can beguile you by various methods into thinking that there is a secret beyond that, you're still ignorant.
So, well, a Westerner would say, well, why couldn't he tell you that in the first place?
Oh, because that would be like explaining a joke before you saw it. And you wouldn't get the effect of the laugh. It would also be like trying to describe music to someone who hasn't heard it. And when you read the reports of the music critics in the Times, they're very beautifully written, but they give you no impression whatsoever of what actually happened at the concert. In order to know what happened at the concert, you have to follow certain instructions. Mm. In other words, a musical notation consists of a set of instructions as to what to do with your voice or with a violin. And then if you do follow those instructions, you will hear the music. So basically, Zen does involve certain instructions. The instruction to see if you can do what I described a little while ago, which is bring the mind to silence. And when you do that, incidentally, I must point out a technical problem here. You don't do it by suppressing your thoughts. Because you can't do that. That would be like trying to smooth rough water with a flat iron. What you do is to let your thoughts ramble, but listen to them as if they were nonsensical noise, like birds chattering outside or rain falling on the roof. And you just let them go blah, 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 blah. You let go and listen. Now in that state you make an astonishing discovery. The discovery that what is really is an eternal now. There is no past, because all memories are present. There is no future, because all anticipations are present. There is no differentiation between the thinker and the thoughts, because that is a concept, just an idea. The thinker is one of the thoughts, and the thoughts are just da 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 da. And you wake up with amazement to discover that there is no reality but now, and all. And you actually experience, just as you feel the sounds coming out of silence, you begin to see the light coming out of space, vibrating at you. Not solid things sitting permanently around, but say we're in a library, and the books in this room are all buzzing at me. They're with light. Just as when I listen to sound, I hear, as you hear now on the radio, this sound emerging from silence. So that the void represented by silence and space is the source of all vibration and existence. We say, but how could it? Ex nihilo nihil fit. Nothing comes out of nothing. Oh no. Something comes out of nothing, because you can't have something without nothing, just as you can't have stars without space. Where would the stars be without space?
Now, can we come back to our hypothetical student?
Yes.
Who is unfortunately sitting there, having been trapped by his master. Now what?
Well, him. This is, of course, the critical moment of Zen. Once I was having tea with a Zen master and a psychiatrist. That was Nyogen Senzaki and Fritz Kunkel. And Kunkel said to Senzaki, "Oh, Mr. Senzaki, I suppose that in your work you have a lot of neurotic people." And he said, "Yes." He said, "What do you do about them?" "I trap them." "Oh, Mr. Senzaki, how do you mean that you trap them?" "I get them where they can't ask any more questions." And that's called in Zen being in the predicament of a mosquito biting an iron bull. Now, it's the nature of the mosquito to bite. It's the nature of an iron bull not to be biteable. And so the irresistible force meets the immovable object. And there's a quandary, a stoppage, a block. The meaning of this block is that you have suddenly discovered that your imaginary ego doesn't exist. your ego is nothing but a combination of your image of yourself, your role, your personality, what people have told you you are, which includes almost no information about your living organism. Combination of that and, two, a chronic sense of muscular tension, which we have acquired in the course of our upbringing, when people like one's mother tell you, try to go to sleep. You must have a bowel movement every day after breakfast. Try. Or the teacher says in class, pay attention. And everybody frowns and stares at the teacher, which has absolutely nothing to do with paying attention. In fact, it gets in the way of it. Just like staring at a distant object, to see it clearly makes your eyes fuzzy. And you have to relax your eyes to see it. So the combination of the image of oneself and this chronic sense of tension is our false impression of the ego. The Zen teacher that is showing the student that that is completely unreal and ineffectual. And that's why he gets him in a situation where he's completely tied up and feels he can do nothing.
So the Zen teacher has, in fact, in his hands, a range of techniques for dealing with different...
Oh, yes. And the whole matter is individual. In other words, a good teacher does not instruct a group. He takes each student individually and gives him what he thinks is appropriate to his particular temperament.
Now, will he know this of himself, or will he know it because of the Zen tradition from which he can take?
Well, he knows it very largely from the Zen tradition, because, you see, the Zen tradition works in a funny way. The beginning of it is the enlightenment experience. But after that, one has to train to know how to teach it to all sorts and conditions of men. And that's the long part of the training. How to become what the Buddhists call a bodhisattva, that is to say, a Buddha returned back into the world. In the beginning of Zen, you attain the Buddha realization. Then you have to come back as a bodhisattva to share it with all sentient beings. And that is the hard part of the task, because that requires great subtlety and discrimination.
Dr. Watts, has Zen altered its character according to the time or people who were teaching it over the centuries, or has it been not essentially the same, but has it been apparently the same?
Oh yes, Zen is a very adaptable way, and it always does that. However, as I said to you earlier, the Zen seminary, which is a better translation than monastery, has increasingly become something like an ecclesiastical boys' boarding school, because of the fact that the young students are dutiful, obedient, but nevertheless reluctant. And so, just as in the West, where you read about methods of Jesuit or Salesian meditation, which are all programmed, these are made for boys who don't know how to think and have to be taught how to think, or whatever else it is they're doing. So there is a certain aspect of the military school to Zen, especially in Japan. And I view this with a certain disfavor.
Now, have there been changes of this kind over the history of Zen?
Yes.
Do we know enough about how it was when it started? Could you tell us perhaps
We don't know enough. From all the early records I have read of Zen in China, it was on a rather different basis. It was had much more the individualism of the Taoists, who were, of course, mountain hermits and solitaries and so on. And in those days, the work of a Zen student was not so much sitting in a monastery as traveling from master to master, trying to find the one who could illuminate him. So it was a walking Zen more than a sitting Zen.
And thereafter?
Thereafter, as Zen settled in Japan, it put more and more emphasis on sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, in Buddhism, there are what are called the four dignities: walking, standing, sitting, and lying. The way a Buddha does all four. Well, a sitting Buddha is all very well, but he also has to be walking, standing, and lying. That means relaxing or sleeping. So I think those aspects have been underemphasized in Zen as we see it in Japan today.
Mm-hmm.
Although Zen in America, as I've seen it, we have that huge monastery at Tassajara at the end of the Carmel Valley in California. They have about 50 to 80 students there, and they work like anything, gardening and building and cleaning the place up and so on. So they don't underemphasize the work aspect of Zen, the active aspect.
Yes. Now they will be getting essentially the same kind of treatment from the masters there, or the master there, as would someone say 600 or 700 years ago.
We don't know. There isn't enough clarity of record to make that comparison.
Are there any books in the history of Zen? I know there are no textbooks in that sense, as you've already said, but are there...
Oh, yes. I would say the most important is the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, and that exists in translation in several editions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after that, a book that is not yet published except in French, but will be out in English in due course, and that's called in Japanese the Rinzai Roku, the Record of Rinzai, which was written about 800, and it's the sermons of a very great Zen teacher in China. Then after that, I would say for an English-speaking reader, a book called Zen in English Literature by R.H. Blyth, B-L-Y-T-H. And that, I think, is readily available. He was an Englishman who studied Zen in Korea for many years and then taught at a private school in Tokyo. Very good. There is my own book, The Way of Zen, which is available in England, in Pelican Books, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And there is Suzuki's Introduction to Zen, a very concise and very good book. And there are some writings of Christmas Humphreys on one called Zen for the West that is worth studying. Oh, I could go on and on retailing the literature. But
that's plenty, I should
yes.
say. Did Zen, over the centuries in China and Japan, spread into the ordinary culture in any visible way?
Oh, yes. It seeped in. And you can see it in the architecture of Japan with its emphasis on emptiness, spaciousness, and on the admiration of what Lao Tzu called the uncarved block, that is to say, of natural wood with all the grain showing. You can see it in Japanese gardens, especially in the rocks that they cultivate. They talk about bonseki, which means the cultivation of rocks. And they admire rocks that look like clouds. You can see it in the tea ceremony, which is a purely secular ceremony. I mean, it has no religious imagery attached to it. It's just drinking tea in a rather formal way. And that's full of Zen. Because Zen would say, every time you say Buddha, wash out your mouth. Because Zen could be called the religion of non-religion, going beyond all religious forms, regarding them all as idols. Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven image, but the most dangerous graven images are those made of imagination, not of wood and stone. So Zen goes beyond the images of God to the reality, which is...
Yes, it made me jump.
And So Zen has penetrated the aesthetics of China and Japan very considerably.
And it's generalized into art in any way?
Yes, especially in the practice of black ink calligraphy and what is called sumi-e, or black ink painting, as done by Sesshu and others.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it has gone into athletics. Aikido, judo, are very much penetrated by Zen influence. And so, of course, is fencing or kendo. Archery, likewise, is Herigel's book on Zen and the art of archery, which is very good. It's gone into the arts of flower arrangement, and so even swimming.
Mm-hmm. Has Zen had an easy passage in the cultures of China and Japan, or has it been in competition with state religion at any time, or had to go underground at any time?
It had to go underground in China, as I remember, towards the end of the Song Dynasty. Japan has had easier going, because the Zen people were very smart in Japan. They terrified the brigands and samurai people by not being afraid of death. And so the samurais thought, well, heavens, if we could learn what they know, we'd be much better off. And so they went to study Zen and applied it to fencing and fighting. But they found themselves, in a way, hoisted by their own petard, because the highest school of Japanese swordsmanship is called the No-Sword School, or Moon in the Water. And there's a movie about this in which Mifune acts the part of Miyamoto Musashi, and it takes you four nights to see it, because it's three nights to see it. It's three sets of two-hour films. Beautiful. Oh, gorgeous technique. But throughout it, there's a Zen master in the background who is teaching Musashi how to be a true samurai. Mm-hmm. And in the end, Musashi is disillusioned with being a fighter and sees that it's all empty and of no avail.
Oh, so it really was self-defeating, the whole
exercise
of the samurai.
All Zen is like that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It gets you going on trying to meditate and attain enlightenment in just the same way as it might get you going on being a master fencer. And in the end, you realize.
Yes.
I was grasping at smoke.
Hmm. Now, we've heard a lot about Zen Koan, someone who doesn't know any more about Zen than I did at the start of this interview, will have heard of the koan, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Can you tell me something about those?
Koan has the same meaning in Zen as the word case has in law. That is to say, a precedent. An ancient case, which is quoted in court. So an ancient case of a dialogue between master and student is brought up for another student for him to decide what is the meaning of the case. So Hakuin, who lived in the 17th century, asked the question, what is the sound of one hand? Now this, of course, is based on an old Chinese proverb which says, one hand doesn't make a clap. It isn't, though, the way Hakuin phrased it, what is the sound of one hand clapping? It is simply, what is the sound of one hand? Now it depends whether you ask that question in English or in Japanese. You have to be, the trouble with koans is that they are incredibly simple. And you have to be like a child to answer them. Look, in Japanese, I'm not going to say it in Japanese, but what is the sound of one hand? Well, obviously, the sound of one hand.
Hmm.
In English, the answer is what? That's what it says. It says, what is the sound of one hand? Stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So other koans are answered in gestures or movements, but you always have to simplify yourself to become really down to the nitty-gritty of what you are actually experiencing in order to get it.
Mm-hmm. One does hear of students spending years on these damn things. Is this part of the sifting down.
Yes,
to
of course it is, because
direct awareness.
They are much too civilized and much too complicated to understand the simplicity of it. Of course, there is much more to it than what I've said. Like when a student has satisfactorily given an answer to a koan, the teacher next tells him that he would like him to give a poem which will express its meaning. And he's to find that poem in an anthology of ancient poems, which is called the Zen Rinkushu. And it's a fascinating little book of really great lines of verse.
Mm-hmm.
Only like haiku, very short. For example, the waters before and the waters after, now and forever flowing, follow each other. There's one.
Beautiful.
If you ask where the flowers come from, even the god of spring doesn't know. In the scenery of spring, there is nothing superior, nothing inferior. Flowering branches grow naturally, some short, some long. Things like that.
Lovely they are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So, also involved in Zen training, there's a great deal of ritual.
Can you tell me something about that?
Well, the chanting of sutras and the proper ways of offering incense, of walking. The chanting of sutras is very important because that involves what is called in Sanskrit mantra, the use of sound to quieten or silence the mind, where you're chanting the words not so much for their meaning as for their very sound, what the Hindus call shabda, the basic vibration of the universe.
Okay.
And by concentration on the pure flow of sound, I mean,
what happens then? Do they kind of take over the body sense? Is this
yes.
the point of them?
Mm-hmm. Take over everything. As, for example, one of the first koans is called Mu.
Mm-hmm.
Mu is the Japanese word for no. And when the Master Choshu was asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? He said, Mu. Everybody in Mahayana Buddhism knows that every living being has Buddha nature. But why did he then say no? What's the puzzle there? Mu. So you can think about it intellectually and get nowhere. That Mu symbolizes the primal void from which everything emerges and so on and so on and so on. It's much simpler than that. The answer is Mu. Mu.
Now, the student would have discovered that after searching out all the other possibilities
yes.
to the answer.
The teacher almost invariably in the Orient makes you find out for yourself. He doesn't spoon-feed anything to you. It's a different conception of pedagogics from that of the West, mm-hmm. where we're always trying to make it like French without tears. And in the Orient, they make you find out for yourself.
Well, this is a mode of learning where, in fact, you can only find out for yourself,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
It's not information as such that you're being given.
No, it's not information. It's a new sensation, almost. Mm-hmm. It's a new state of consciousness.
Now, this is what I wanted to ask you. Interesting, very interesting, that you should say that the Enlightenment is the first thing that happens, which is quite different from the religions of the West we know, which is the final attainment, after which the story ends happily ever after. Is it then married to the waking state in the ordinary day-to-day world? Are the two halves, the direct apprehension and the day-to-day life, then married, or do they become
indeed
the same? Or?
They become the same. There's a famous saying in Zen where somebody asks, what is the Tao, that is to say, the true way? And he answers, your ordinary mind is Tao. Well, how then do you get into accord with it? And the teacher replies, if you try to accord, you deviate. So when it really comes down to it, and this is the most fascinating thing of all to me, when you go through the whole thing, you finally come to the understanding that your everyday consciousness, just as it is the same as Buddha's awakening. That just doing the ordinary things, boiling water, making up a fire, driving a car, looking at the trees, all that's it. That is in no way different from union with God, as we would say in the West. That's it. Only. Sometimes the longest way round is the shortest way home. Like in the parable of the prodigal son. And it may take a long time to see it, because it's too obvious. It is too clear, says a poem, and so it is hard to see. When you know that the light in your lantern is fire, your rice is cooked from the beginning.
Dr. Watts, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you.